woman friends about like physical intimacy issues in her relationship, and they were kind of like confiding each other, and she was like, well, yeah, sex, at least let's talk about it. So yeah, revolution, at least let's talk about it. I mean, it seems to be like incipiently happening in other places, but people try, like people rising up all over the place, like these incredible things burst upon the scene. Egypt, you know, the Arab Spring, and Occupy here, and of course I can't compare those because we didn't really fundamentally challenge the institutional arrangements, but there was a sort of incipient potentiality of that. What's going on in Ukraine, these, you know, these situations where there's real social ferment and the game is in question. Now the game in the United States doesn't seem to be really fundamentally in question. How do you put the game in question? What is the game? do we have agreement among cable listeners, among whoever? Are there people talking about this? So anyway, we're putting it out there, reform or revolution, which of course comes from Rosa Luxemburg's, she wasn't the only one talking about it, but an essay she wrote back, I don't know, somewhere around 100 years ago. I can't remember.
I think it was 1900.
1900, a little over 100 years ago. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, where we strive to stimulate, incite discussion, and hopefully some action. And the number to call in is 503-231-8187. So, Tomas, we were talking yesterday. This kind of came together at the last minute. We were talking here at KBOO. I had this idea for this show. I actually didn't have a guest. And we started talking, and we thought, well, let's go on and talk about it together. So you've been living in Portland for...
I've been here for 5 years.
Uh-huh. And, but... You've been, so you're involved with IWW, mm-hmm. and obviously IWW is a great group to talk about, from which vantage point to talk about this, because obviously they were one of the few union movements, certainly in this country, that was openly talking about challenging the actual institutional structures of power and not just getting... benefit wage increases and stuff, which is the way unionism has basically gone for the past 80 years, something mm-hmm. like that. So talk about your experiences in IWW, your, you know, how you got to be where you are, basically. In your thought, in your politics.
It's pretty broad. I don't know. I mean, I guess my first experience with unions was with AFL-CIO when I was 19. I had for many years been interested in labor organizing, and I don't really know why, but it was something that I was drawn to. So I found out about an opportunity to go to something that the AFL-CIO calls Union Summer, and went and was accepted and had an, you know, essentially an internship for 3 months. They sent me and a couple other young guys down to rural northern Mississippi to try to organize a printing plant under the Graphic Communications International Union with some experienced organizers. And they had I don't remember the precise numbers, but I think it was like that they had 11 union votes in the last 15 years. All of them failed, of course. And, you know, that experience was interesting because, first of all, it seemed like it was futile to begin with, that there was just no chance that these workers were gonna vote to organize. There's too much underlying distrust amongst the workers themselves for anybody to feel like they wanted to be in a union with somebody else, not to mention the capitalists telling them all the usual lies. But so one of the things that I learned out of that I felt was really ironic is that the lead organizers all had a union for organizers within a union. And I asked one of them, I was like, this is a union that you work for. You're an organizer. Why is it that the union that you work for doesn't just provide you with a good wage and working conditions like you all want. Why do you need to have a union and fight for a contract, you know, within a union? And everybody had a laugh and, you know, didn't really have any good answers for it, which is fine, I suppose. But it just showed me kind of that was the first time that I saw kind of the hypocrisy of the mainstream unions, you know. So when I moved to Portland 5 years ago, I started driving a pedicab. There was a lot of stuff going on. One of the companies in town was really, really harsh, constantly pushing their workers to pay more money, tacking on fees and fines for the workers for showing up 5 minutes late to pick up a cab. And remember, these are supposed to be independent contractors that don't have to show up at any particular time because they're independent contractors. And so, you know, I started to lead some organizing discussions about what people want to do, and was told by my brother at the time that there was a branch of the IWW in town. So I contacted them, met with a delegate from the IWW, and started reading through some stuff. And I was like, "Yep, this is my union." And I joined, and I've been a member since. And have worked on lots of different organizing campaigns and at different capacities at different times over the years. What else do you want to hear from me, Paul?
Well, you know, I just noticed that there's three callers already. Maybe I put out the phone number a little early. It didn't give us a chance to really get rolling here. I'd ask our callers just to hold on for a couple more minutes. We want to sort of actually put out some ideas here. So what do you share with your comrades, with your fellow workers in IWW? Do you feel there is a sense that, obviously, you know, there's a you know, for many, many years, IWW was basically just like, what, an office in Detroit or somewhere?
Chicago,
right? Mainly. I mean, there's obviously people, there are still old, I don't know, are there any original IWW people still alive? Maybe there's a couple.
Oh, gosh.
But
I don't know about that.
Maybe not. I mean,
1905.
Right. So anyway, but obviously there's a harking back to the spirit, because we were talking about yesterday that at the turn of the century, of the 18th to 19th century, to a lot of people, including myself, you seem to agree, was perhaps really the last, like, large scale, if not on a total worldwide, is like at least on the industrial, you know, Europeanized countries scale, challenge to the, you know, to the real, there was actually still a real working class solidarity. The factory system was still there. So people were really working together, like forced under brutal conditions to attaining a consciousness of like oppression and the nature of the capitalist system was not a difficult thing to do. And people actually were organizing and actually challenging, you know, in a pretty serious level, it seems like, reading history. So that's the context in which IWW arose, and other, you know, revolutionary organizations around the world. And there are still like these huge debates that really meant something over reform, revolution, because it seemed like revolution was really possible. And then, you know, World War One, you know, just like the War on Terror, seemed to be, you know, either instituted consciously or utilized to basically slaughter a whole generation of the working class and pit people against each other, pit socialist parties against each other who are for or against the war. World War II, same thing. War seems to be always utilized. So anyway, cut to the present, there's been this long period of really non-revolutionary, with the 60s perhaps accepted, and things just seem to be worse and worse. The military-industrial complex has entrenched further its power. The whole union movement has become defanged. So, but I assume that you call yourselves IWW, that you share the sense that, whether it's possible or not, at least having a sense that what we really need to do is seriously look at the underlying structures of instituted authority and power and the nation state and the basic mechanisms by which you know, the ruling class maintains its power. Is that?
Oh, most definitely. That's still in our preamble. Our preamble is still a very radical document that opposes capitalism as it's at its core and as the central kind of piece of that in terms of what we get out of it as workers is abolition of the wage system. We still believe that, you know, we're not in a position to be making demands for abolishing the wage system, although, you know, that's never really been terribly clear. It's not terribly clear. It certainly isn't really clear to us right now what that actually looks like. You know, you could say, oh, I won't work for wages anymore. But you know, what do? We don't have. I mean, I guess the basic idea is that, you know, we workers need to be controlling our means of production. So a lot of people are going about it now in ways that they couldn't and didn't 100 years ago. The same way that we can't organize in a lot of ways that they did back then. Back then, you know, you've got thousands of poor people living in one neighborhood that go and work in one factory or in one mill or in one mine. They all know each other. They talk to each other every day, and they have the same boss. Now we've got thousands of working people who live dispersed in little pockets here and there that you can't really readily identify from everybody else in society, that go and work in a cafe with two other people. And they have those two people have one boss, and the next guy over has one other boss that's a small time boss, and there's a handful of big bosses. So we can't organize in the same way that they used to. So what a lot of people are doing, you know, it's now there's a lot of people, and this isn't, I'm not saying that this is the goals of the IWW. The goals of the IWW is strictly to organize industrially, which means based on your industry, not on your trade. But what a lot of Wobblies are doing these days, and other people, is forming workers collectives to begin to own their means of production, and therefore, in small part, abolish the wage system, at least for themselves, and supporting other workers to do the same kind of thing, which you could argue is a reformist or a revolutionary act. You could argue it both ways, I'm sure. I think that probably a lot of my friends would call that a reformist act more than anything else. I wanted to ask you, Paul, what if you could define for the callers that are waiting on the line, maybe to give a little bit of direction to this word revolution, because I think that people can, when they hear that, it's a pretty loaded word, and people think a lot of different things about it. So I guess I'm wondering what you think that word means, or what context you're referring to it in this conversation.
Well, I mean, it all depends on what your understanding of what it is you want to revolt against, or, you know, have a revolution to change, which is the fundamental question. So, I mean, we were talking yesterday. I've been really taken by this community rights movement, and I've had, I interviewed Thomas Lindsay. I've taped a couple of his talks. I've talked to Paul Cienfuegos, and just on an analytic level, it seems like revolution means like a change of the underlying mechanisms that allow whatever, however you define power, allow these the unbalanced power relations to continue. And so, you know, he's an environmental lawyer, and he was trying to stop like factory hog farms in Pennsylvania and other things, and basically realized that the tools that he was using within the constituted legal system that we all implicitly accept living in the society, just as we implicitly accept the existence of the police, we implicitly accept the existence of the state, even however we might mentally, you know, not accept it, we, you know, whatever. So he came to the conclusion that the regulatory system was inherently flawed. The legal system itself was flawed from the beginning, from the Constitution itself. So, I mean, I was reading this. We're talking about the IWW, Daniel De Leon, and we can talk about him because apparently he changed his views later in life. But he has this talk he gave called Reform or Revolution, and he talks about revolution being that reform is a reform of externalities, And he has this very amusing thing. Take, for instance, a poodle. You can reform him in a lot of ways. You can shave his whole body and leave a tassel at the tip of his tail. You may bore a hole through each ear and tie a blue bow on one end and a red bow on the other. Anyway, it's kind of amusing, but he says revolution is revolution within, and it's a very complex argument. But so, yeah, there's something which allowed in the establishment of this nation state itself, and in the Constitution itself, in the power relations that were there at the very beginning, the commercial power relations. It was basically an attempt to gain more control over the ability to control natural resources and trade, and so you just got a new class of people that ended up gaining that, and because there was such an incredible wealth of resources and free slave labor and, you know, indentured servant labor and all that, it's the United States, and then it expanded west and gained more and more resources and land, and became this humongous power that we know today. But it was on the basis of what was in the Constitution, the Commerce Clause, the whole structure of the way it was set up, which favored the wealthy and the people who had property and resources. It favored them and their ability to amass more, and they just amassed more and more, and corporations gained more and more power. So we have to really seriously look at the underlying structure of law, the establishment of the nation state, all this stuff. It's difficult, maybe impossible. We balk at confronting it, but the way things are going, you know, looking at all the indicators, it just seems like it just doesn't seem like we're going to get there if we continue to accept the given structures. So maybe we should go to a couple callers right now. Garrett, am I on the line? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm also a fellow union member. I worked with the First Transit to get the Region 3 union up. Honestly, I didn't do as much as others because I was kind of new to both the job and the whole union apparatus at the time. But like the guy there, I saw some pretty ugly things during that. But the outcome far outweighed the ugliness that I saw in the process, especially having family that worked there, knowing that they're safe from just being terminated for no reason except that you spoke up. It feels good to know that, although I was fired before we got the contract. Mm. So, you know, they're safe, but I'm back to minimum wage.
Sounds pretty standard.
I do really feel that one of the things that probably prevents us from ever having any kind of revolution is the way we're conditioned as children. I remember I was bullied a lot in school growing up, and one of the things that was pounded into me was that you do not have the right to defend yourself against anything. You don't have the right to stand up for yourself. And when I did, even just when I was beaten up, and I wasn't even trying to fight back, I was punished for just being beaten up. I was given suspensions for exactly the same amount of time as the kids who were on top of me, pounding me down. And I was told by quite a few school officials, sometimes you have to accept the punishment for doing the right thing. And that just made no sense to me. It still doesn't make any sense to me now. But I hear that kind of absolute nonsense coming out of people as if it's some kind of dogma that you have to live by. And there are some things that are really, really wrong with the psychology in this country that I feel absolutely prevent us from ever being able to rise up and throw off sickness that really controls us.
You kind of hit on one that I think Paul and I both agree on is definitely a hindrance to people actually throwing off the shackles of oppression which is the individualism, you know. What the principal said kind of pushes you in that direction. It's like, well, you know, you got to take your lumps yourself, kind of stuff like that. Like, I'm not going to be in this for you. I'm not going to support you. And we all get told that all the time, like you said, you know. We all get told, like, do it yourself, you know. And you know, boys will get told, like, be a man, you know, all this kind of stuff. Like, you're strong on your own. You don't need anybody else to help you out. You don't need to help anybody else. In fact, you shouldn't help anybody else out, because you could get in trouble for it.
And it, that even within a union, you see that growing. You have a group of people who are banding together, but you still have some in the group who want people to band around them. They're mm-hmm. not willing to band around you, and they're even insulted at the thought that you would ask them to do that.
Yep.
All right, well, thanks for calling, Garrett. We have another couple callers. We'd like to talk at greater length with each person, but unfortunately, if we're going to have a wider conversation, we need to kind of limit it. But thanks for calling, and we have Joel on the line.
Hey, guys. I really agree with Garrett there. I have a comment on the broader question. I agree with you guys. Well, I think we, you know, to the really broad question, I think we do need revolution. A lot of, you know, academics, activists believe this now. It's almost, I think it's kind of ignorant to not believe that. But I was going to say one comment on it. Activists I really respect, historian Tariq Ali says this, and it was a realization, sort of. He says, you know, yes, the rising up and the people in the streets is utterly important, you know, like in Egypt. Like the previous caller said, we don't have that climate in large enough amounts. But the thing that happens after that is also utterly important. I mean, Tariq Ali points out that politics will go on. I mean, I want these, you know, I would love to throw off capitalism, but, you know, you can call it what you want. Mind that politics has a lot of connotations, and people hate politics. But, you know, you guys are on this page. You're talking specific, you know, policy. You're talking, you know, checks. And so I just kind of wanted to throw that in there, because I thought it was, you know, some people don't realize that we have to put, you know, caps upon, you have to put guards against human power, you know, humans in that history, power, you know, consolidates. And I got to take my comment off the air, but I was just going to throw it in there. Anyway, thanks, guys. Thanks for your program.
Thanks. All right, thanks, Joel.
I mean, Joel brings up a good one that I've been thinking about regarding this conversation, which is Egypt. You know, people talk about the Egyptian revolution and all this, and it's like, well, it looked like revolution. People certainly died like it was. But what happened in the end is that as soon as, you know, the dictator's out of power, then the moderates that joined long after everything had been moving forward, that provided it with enough push to force the dictator out, then they back up and they say, oh, okay, everything's good now. Everything's going to be fine now. You know, they've said they're going to make changes. They've changed the court. You know, the military's not in power. Oh, but the military is in power. But the military helped us take the dictator out of power. So they're our friends now, even though they've been the ones that have been doing all the oppressing for all these years, right? And it's like, so then what happens is that the people who are the real revolutionaries, who had been out there, you know, the group of 100 or so people that were out in the streets every month getting their heads clubbed, getting arrested, and disappeared in some cases, you know, those people who were out there as the first example to everybody else in the country that, hey, we can do this. This is wrong. 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 No matter what they do to me, this is still wrong, right? Those people who started it all, they got pushed out in favor of moderate voices, in favor of people who were already powerful political figures or religious figures or capitalist figures. And then those people end up making the same exact decisions as were being made before, because it's in their benefit to hold on to power.
Yeah, this term I've used a lot when I get on the air is recuperation, which is a more widely used in Europe, in different languages, than co-optation. We tend to use co-optation. It's that point where you're not convinced enough in yourself, or you don't have the strength of conviction or the strength of spirit or the enthusiasm or the support or whatever it takes. I'm not sure what that is. What makes a so-called real revolutionary someone who, as you said, is willing to take the hits and also to take the criticism, to go out on a limb, to risk being risk their friendships, even risk, because sometimes, what are the core principles or the core beliefs or the core feeling of necessity or whatever it is that we're striving for? It's like it's so easy to be pulled back in to the orbit of the established ways of doing things, the easy ways of doing things. I don't know. I'm being very vague, so maybe we should just go to another caller. We got another caller in line, Steve? Steve's not. Timothy, you're on the air, Timothy.
Ah, thank you very much, and thank you for having this discussion. It's fabulous. First, let me give props to the IWW and its long, illustrious history. I lose a lot of sleep to this topic, and I think we're pretty well in agreement here. I mean, you've pretty well hit out the case that over this last century worth of decline, the left has been systematically excluded from the electoral politics. The ever more invasive tentacles of surveillance and COINTELPRO-esque apparatus have made it very difficult to organize in any useful way that creates a critical mass of empowerment. Wealth is systematically being sucked upwards perpetually. And if you want to wrest power from the people that currently hold it, I mean, we've progressed into what pretty well amounts to a right-wing corporate oligarchy with all the apparatus in place for a very oppressive fascist state, if it's not that already, I mean, depending on your definition. It occurs to me that if you want to get the critical mass of activity to go up against something like that, you're going to run up against strategies and end games and apparatus that have been designed and placed for a long time now. And I'm not very optimistic about that. I mean, if somebody wanted to wrest power from the people that currently hold it, it would be incredible bloody carnage. My most optimistic efforts have been where I've seen people create new things that can survive the inevitable collapse of capitalism, which is a house of cards as it currently stands.
Well, so that kind of brings us to the question of the discussion today, which is reform or revolution, and there's definitely blurred lines in it, I think, in a lot of ways. But
what I want to get to here is that really in our current situation in the United States, as I see it, the biggest power that you have is where you spend your money. So choosing things like keeping your money in the local economy, bartering, creating new currencies, creating co-ops, creating worker-owned collectives, creating apparatus that are not controlled by capitalism are an incredible mechanism that moves things forward and that are out of the, well, the more insular you can create these apparatus, the more likely they will be to survive the inevitable collapses that I think are probably being engineered as we speak.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Thomas.
I was going to say that a lot of times people bring up spending money in the local economy, and I certainly agree with being a lot more local in general with everything that we do, especially things that we consume. But I guess a lot of times people talk about that and they feel like shopping at a local small store is going to like somehow change the world or the way that capitalism works. I know that's not what the caller was just talking, that wasn't their overarching point, but it's something that people bring up a lot. They're like, you know, I shop locally. And it's like, well, shopping, are you still purchasing from a capitalist? Are you purchasing a product from a capitalist that some other massive capitalist had produced in China by slaves? If you are, then it's not doing anything except for giving a little bit money, more money to the local smaller time capitalist than to the far away big time capitalist. But you're leaving the fundamental system, which is exploitation, which is exploitative to workers in place, you know, because that local small business person might be a really, really nice person. John might be really, really, really sweet to you as a customer and still fire a worker the next day for showing up 5 minutes late twice in a week because they had to take care of their kid.
Yeah, I wanted to, I think he brings up some really crucial issues here. I think there is some unclarity from what I heard. One thing I heard, and he's probably not on the line anymore to respond. I guess that's the power that we have behind these mics.
I don't have my finger on the button. That's Steve.
Yeah, right. anyway, so the idea of resting power that is inevitably like this bloody thing, and it seems like there's sort of, you know, and that might be true, and that's a horrifying thing to think of, and that does scare a lot of people off. We had talked about this yesterday, but it seems like so the conclusion then is then the system can't be changed, and he sort of mentioned waiting for this inevitable collapse. Okay, that's like there's these various scenarios, you know, that we need to bring them out that are like either unconscious or like dimly conscious, like. How is change possible? How does change come about? What are the possible scenarios? Frankly, it's if you listen to Cable a lot, if you read a lot, it's frankly very, very frightening what's coming down in front of us, and so it seems like the only thing that could prevent it from becoming as frightening as it appears that it might be is to actually consciously try to, despite the impossibilities of it, try to come together and confront it, because it's going to be ugly no matter what, it seems to me. Anyway, so the idea is, okay, so then you step back. It seems like what the caller was saying was you step back, and where our power really lies is in spending our money. Well, maybe, but that implies that, and I would agree with that, if you get a million people, you know, within the next 6 months to take a concerted action together on whatever topic, you know, you're talking about, which it's a vicious circle, because we don't have the means to collectively organize ourselves so that a million people or 100, you know, or 20,000 people in Portland, maybe 30,000 people made a collective choice together to do one particular thing, that would be powerful in Portland. You know, if we had 1,000 people at any one of those anti-eviction protests, they probably wouldn't have been evicted. Sure. But so you can't just say, oh, our power is in where we spend our money and just think it's magically going to happen. It's like, no, the problem is still, how are you going to get together and think together and do things together? It's like you can't avoid that problem. It is difficult. So, you know, boycotts. Yeah, sure. Boycotts are great ideas. You know, even a petition. I think some of these petitions I've seen on the internet, yeah, if you got 5 million people on one of those petitions, then that actually might people really stand up and notice. Like, but that's the thing. It's still the same game we're talking about. Anyway, you want to add some before we go to our next caller?
Are there?
We have Jane on the line. Oh, James. Oh, still no women. But here we go. James?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to bring a Ron Paul libertarian perspective to the table, if I may.
Oh, give it a shot. Give it a shot.
Labor is owned by international bankers through monetary, tax, and regulatory policy administered by our central government. If you give control of the means of production to labor, you are giving further power to the international bankers who control our nation.
How does that argument make sense? If workers have power, then bankers have more power?
what they do, what you, the labor's own through regulatory, tax, and monetary policy.
Well, it is currently, but if you challenge that system too, then that's what we're talking about. We're talking about challenging that system.
Okay, well, there was a caller earlier mentioned that we are a right-wing corporatist oligarchy, mm-hmm. right? Okay. Now, as an advocate for our nation's constitutional, as defined by Jefferson and Madison, we are what you guys define as a right-wing corporatist oligarchy as a direct result of adopting progressive left policy.
No, how about the Commerce Clause? How about the Commerce Clause? How about the Commerce Clause in the Constitution?
That's a very good question. The Commerce Clause, in fact, I got my Constitution book right here. The Commerce Clause is to regulate.
Hello?
I'm sorry. You're getting the complex stuff here. But basically, the Commerce Clause, the purpose of the Commerce Clause, it gave the federal government the power, what it was to keep trade open between the states. All the rulings on the Commerce Clause since, I believe it was, since the first rulings are, okay, let's see. The narrowest definition of to regulate is to make regular. That is to facilitate the free flow of goods, but not except in cases of danger to prohibit the flow of goods.
Yeah, exactly. Prohibit the flow of goods. That's what the people who control the flow of goods, the people who control the economic power, they're able to amass more power and able to establish the corporate oligarchy that we're talking about. Exactly.
Yeah, but see, what originally it was to keep open the flow of goods.
But,
yeah,
for who? But for whose benefit? That's the thing. Who are these guys that wrote this Constitution? They were a bunch of really, really wealthy people, a lot of people who held titles and had lots of land, and many of whom, if not most, had slaves. That's not the people in my mind. I am the people. You're probably the people. I don't know who you are. Like, we are the people. It's not them. They didn't write it for us. They didn't write it
The federal system. The federal system gave control of the means of production to the people through the people's authority to tax and regulate industry at the local level. When the central government was given the authority to regulate industry, establish a central bank, and to tax the people directly, that took control of the means of production from the people.
I think we differ on what the means of production mean. I don't know if we mean the same thing when you're talking about the means of production.
Well, what basically, and this is, guys, you guys are going to experience some cognitive dissonance here. Basically, the progressive left movement is a creation by the ruling class. It is a faction created by the ruling class. It was designed to divide the union of the people, and they have successfully did it.
Are you saying that the union that I'm a member of was created by bankers?
I am saying that all these factions on the left.
I mean, I agree with you, actually. I should agree with you.
That are factions that are used to divide the union that is government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And if we're going to unite the 99%, we have to interpret the Constitution as Jefferson and Madison interpreted. They were the primary, Madison was the primary author of the Constitution. They were the ones who put the government power in the hands of the people.
Well, I think we got another caller, and I think we're probably not going to come to a place of good resolution on these interpretations here. It would probably take a 2 or 3 hour long conversation. Even then, we'd probably end up just being extremely frustrated. And that's no disrespect to you, but I just don't think
understand.
I don't think we're going to be able to get much further with this conversation in the time constraints.
Thank you for
allowing
me to talk.
I appreciate your calling. All right.
Bye.
Bye.
And we have Harry on the line.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, yeah. Greetings, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yes.
my comment is our country, we are in a two-party plutocracy, and the only way labor can why conservatives are in control is because they're in both parties. The labor is not in both parties. They're either in the Democratic Party or on fringe parties. What they need to do is they need to join, be in both parties. That way they can control who the candidates are, who our representatives are.
So you're arguing the reform over revolution,
yes,
of this discussion then. Could you elaborate more on why you feel like reform, why this sort of reform, why infiltrating both parties, I guess, would be...
Well, there's only two parties.
Okay. But
they're the ones in power. You have to understand that. They're the ones in power. So we need the left wing of the Republican Party. We need a left wing of the Democratic Party.
So how much time do you think this will take to achieve? What kind of changes do you want to ultimately make? Where do you want to go with this? And how much time would it take to actually get there?
Well, that's why the people with money are in control. They are in both parties.
No, but you're not answering my question. Where do you want to get with this? What kind of society do you want to live in, and how much time would it take to get to that kind of society through the strategies that you're advocating?
That your question, all I can say is that this is my way. How it's going to do it is how long will it take? Well, you're in control. You have something to say. Right now, you have nothing to say. You're in no control. You're not in control of media or anything like that. So it has to be both parties. You have to be in both parties.
Well, you're just repeating the same thing you said at the beginning. I don't mean to be contentious here, but okay, I want to live in a society in which there's we're not toxifying the environment, where we don't have slave labor, we're not forced to work in these stupid, demeaning jobs to make other people wealthy. We don't have like these people flying around in these jets constantly all over the world making these economic decisions. I mean, it's insanity. It's total insanity. And and global warming is like upon us. Fukushima happened. We've got Hanford up the river. There's like this massive chemical spill in the Elk River, oil trains exploding all over the place. I mean, it's insane. It's disastrous. It's our cities are unlivable. Rents, we have to pay this exorbitant rents. It's ridiculous. So to get to a society in which the things that I mentioned don't exist anymore, it seems like it's going to take a lot. And so how is infiltrating both political parties, how long is that strategy going to take to actually eliminate those bad things that I was talking about?
Oh, probably about 10 to 25 years. Ooh. The first strategy would be throw all the bums out. No incumbents. You run for the Congress, 2 years.
Right,
about 2 years. We throw you out.
Okay, but that's a good on a theoretical, but again, it's back to the same question. Wait.
You have to have steps all the way through. Whining and complaining is not, the way you're whining and complaining is not going to get anything done. If you join both parties, it will. The Republican Party is the party of Lincoln. Make it the party of Lincoln and Lenin. The Democrat Party is the party of Jefferson. Make it the party of Jefferson and Mao.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess there's I have a fundamental disagreement with you on the basic nature of the political system and the kind of power that we could possibly wield, regardless of what sort of activity we take. But I did want to ask you a question, though, that Paul was trying to ask you, which is, what do you want to see? What kind of world do you want to see? Not how do you want to get there, but what do you want to see?
What I want to see is, what I noticed, I mean, like when Garrett was called in, suffering. There's a lot of suffering going on right now because of the economic downturn.
Are you suffering?
Suffering.
Are you not getting enough food to eat.
People not getting enough housing. And all the suffering we see going on, what can we do about it? Well, political change, reform.
Do you feel yourself that you're suffering?
I see it around me. I know people who are. Well, I consider myself lucky because I belonged to a good union. Mm-hmm. I belong to AFSCME. I'm now disability retirement, but I have a pension. And this pension lasts me for the rest of my life. And luckily because I put in 20 years, but I have there's people out here who live only on Social Security, and they're barely making it.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
Okay.
And I do would like to make an announcement here that coming up. By the way, you are listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name's Paul, and my guest is Tomas. Help! Tomas Bernal. Sorry, Tomas. And we're talking about reform or revolution, and this is a subject that needs to go on for hours and hours. And I encourage people to get into conversations, get into reading groups, study groups, take this stuff seriously, get involved in whatever political group, and then talk about this question in ways that are maybe more interesting and coherent than we're able to do this morning. But coming up on Political Perspectives, we'll hear Radio EcoShock with guest Dr. Michael Jennings of the University of Utah on the worst case scenario of dangerous climate change, and Dr. Sing Chu of Humboldt State University on what we can learn from past dark ages. That's a good follow-up to this program. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints takes a look at the role of the National Endowment for Democracy in the Ukraine crisis. And we hear an update on the battle to protect Jeju Island from a massive U.S. military base between the two Koreas. And 11, on the food show, Christopher Leonard, journalist and author of The Meat Racket, talks about the vertical integration of the poultry industry. And Yvonne Rivero talks about edible insects as an ingredient in Mexican cuisine. That's all very interesting. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support of the community radio station. This community radio station, if you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And we do have still a full slate of callers, so apparently this topic has stirred people up, which is good, so we'll have to do this some more. And Lydia, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I was kind of bummed not to hear from any women right off the bat.
So I tried.
I called like 20 times before I got on.
Thanks for your perseverance.
So I know we're talking about reform or revolution, and I definitely am, on the side of revolution. I don't think, I think we keep trying reform, and I think it just keeps, we get a little bit of what we want. People are fighting for different rights and different, and I support those causes, and I think that's great, but at the same time, I feel like we're distracted from the bigger picture of actually, dealing with the way the system works in general, that we keep trying to do this, it's Democrats now, or it's, who's the better one, who to support, and we lose sight of the fact that we kind of need a revolution, not just to try and reform it piece by piece.
So what would this revolution look like to you?
I don't know. I think I probably have the systematized version of, we all go fight in the streets and stop living the menial life that we're living, and, really coming outside of the, I'm just going to work for my rent, which is what a lot of people are stuck in.
Yep.
Is, I have to work to survive, right? That's what I've been told I have to do. I hear people talk about, this revolution needing to be it needs to be on the inside first, because we are in this individualized system where it's all about me and we're so separated. You're talking about the unions before, everybody worked the same job and they could all talk, and now we're all in our own little worlds, and it's really hard to come together as the people. We're just so separated. I don't know exactly how it should work. I keep asking that question to people I know, how do we do this? How do we make this happen? I don't have an answer, but I want to keep talking about it.
Well, I think that's a good start. And I think, finding occasions to talk to other people on a more of a continual basis. I mean, Tomas is in IWW, so they've got a group of people that already feel this affinity, that meet with each other and have occasions. Well, if you don't belong to a group like that, you know, do you do that at work? Yeah, maybe during coffee, you chat and stuff. But do people have serious conversations about, you know, what's going on? No, people people tend to shy away from, don't talk about politics because it brings up, you know, tension and stuff. So, yeah, so we need to create situations and occasions, which is why I advocate, you know, book clubs, reading clubs. There's these resilient circles now that I think is a really great idea, where neighbors actually get together and have potlucks together. And, you know, there are no magical formulas. When Tomas was talking about, you know, the time that we were, you know, back in the end of the 18th, 19th century, the turn of the century, when there is this real revolutionary fervor, or you'd like talk about like the Spanish Civil War, which a lot of anarchists talk about, where they really had these affinity groups, which were based in neighborhoods, real old rooted neighborhoods, where, again, people really did grow up together and know each other. Okay, so that's a double task. We have to fight this big system that's undermined all that, but we have to recreate that so we can fight the system, in a nutshell. You know, it's a terrible bind we're in. You know, maybe just admitting that we're in a terrible bind to begin with is a first step.
Definitely. I agree. And I think that's where it comes down to, like, a personal level. People have to make that decision or that realization themselves before they can really come out, and before we can all come out and come together in our communities. Because if somebody doesn't believe that on a personal level, they're not going to be able to make the effort to be a part of a community that believes that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just wanted to touch on something real quick about the something I think the first caller had was talking about, and his experience in like in school and what we've all been taught, like growing up, especially if we were schooled in the mainstream. And so I think as a mother to a young child, and knowing other mothers to young children, especially having to work by themselves. It really comes to, like, another good step, I think, is also just instilling those the values that I feel like I didn't get as you know, like that our system didn't want to see in us, giving those to our children, so that they don't have to go through the process of, I mean, we all go through the process of finding ourselves, but so they don't have to fight the unschool, you know, so they don't have to fight to unschool themselves from the system.
Totally. Well, thank you very much for calling, Lydia. We only have 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
We have one Thanks minute left. Me. So I think it would be actually unfair to another caller to ask them to talk for 30 seconds. So we're having to end the show now. Thank you all for calling. I appreciate it. We will have further opportunities, hopefully, to talk about this and other similar topics. Obviously, it did spark a chord because our phone lines were pretty much full the whole time. Thank you very much, Tomas.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on, Paul.
All right. It's been good. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll do this again.
Indeed.
All right. Well, thank you, Steve, our engineer. And thanks to everybody else here at the great KBOO Community Radio Station. Great. I don't know. Is it really great?
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
tune in Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music, from the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes, swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Oh, that was lovely. Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Coming right up on Political Perspectives, we'll hear Radio EcoShock with guests Dr. Michael Jennings of the University of Utah on the worst-case scenario of dangerous climate change, and Dr. Sing Chu of Humboldt State University on what we can learn from past dark ages. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints takes a look at the role of the National Endowment for Democracy in the Ukraine crisis. And we hear an update on the battle to protect Jeju Island from a massive U.S. military base between the two Koreas. At 11 o'clock, we've got The Food Show with Christopher Leonard, journalist and author of The Meat Racket. He'll be talking about the vertical integration of the poultry industry. And Yvonne Rivero talks about edible insects as an ingredient in Mexican cuisine. All that's coming up on the morning lineup here at KBOO. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from xray.fm. The people at xray.fm would like to thank KBOO for 45 years of work in the service of better community radio for Portland and the world. xray.fm is proud to support the pioneering work of KBOO and wouldn't be here without it. And off we go to Political Perspectives. We're going to hear Radio EcoShock with guests Dr. Michael Jennings. And here we go. Thanks for tuning in today.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The bad news is planet Earth is already committed to very dangerous climate change. Dr. Michael Jennings published a paper in 2012 showing we are already in the worst-case scenario. We'll talk with Dr. Jennings. We may be saved from utter disaster if an economic collapse comes sooner rather than later. Dr. Sing C. Chu will give us the good news about the Dark Ages and the signs we are entering one now. In March 2012, the Earth's atmosphere went above 401 parts per million carbon dioxide. The Arctic ice is at an absolute record low this winter, even as eastern North America freezes. New Science is reporting bad news like artillery fire from a climate war zone, increased malaria zones, dying birds, faster Greenland ice melt. Climate disruption is moving faster than anyone can comprehend. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, the cheerful program for pessimists and realists alike. Well, it's official. With no international agreements and ever-growing greenhouse gas emissions, scientists are asking if we're heading off the cliff into climate disruption, into the worst of all worlds. Our guest is Dr. Michael Jennings from the University of Idaho. Last year, he published a paper in the journal Global Policy. Its title is Climate Disruption: Are We Beyond the Worst Case Scenario? Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks, Alex.
So what is the worst-case scenario as put out by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC?
Well, at the time that I wrote the article, the IPCC was still using the framework for scenarios. These are the future scenarios that they project. If we do this, you know, if our economy goes in a certain direction, if we shift to a high technology input, if land use happens in a certain way, and so a series of assumptions about population growth and where it might be, where on the planet different things may occur, the level of industry, the economy, the kinds of activities of human enterprise. And if you put these things together and you say, well, if we had high population growth and rapid development of technology, and we shifted our fuel mix from coal to mostly oil and gas, we could expect this future scenario in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And so the key thing here is, what's the level of greenhouse gas emissions likely to be like in the future under different assumptions about what we humans do? And so they laid this out, and it was a very good, very usable framework that laid out, you know, kind of the, well, if we could just continue the way we're going, that was the business as usual thing, then, you know, we could expect this kind of result. If population growth became much more moderate, if we changed our fuel mix, then we might have a, you know, not business as usual, and emissions could come down.
There's a lot of optimism built into those IPCC predictions, but what did they say? If we just go on as business as usual and population does expand and all those things you've talked about, what were they expecting to happen by 2100 as far as temperature or sea level rise, do you know?
Well, that's the scenario that's commonly referred to as A1FI. That's the shorthand for the family that it's in is A1, and it's fuel-intensive. If we just keep going, we're in a fuel-intensive mode right now. We're using lots of fuel and all the different kinds of fossil fuels. And if we kept going, so let's assume that population growth, here are the basic assumptions under that. And this was the furthest out that, you know, they said, okay, we need to set a boundary, you know, a goalpost way out there that sort of defines the edge of what we think is possible. And that's if the population growth was medium, but world GDP, gross domestic product, was high, and energy use was high, and land use changes are high, and the availability of oil and gas is high, and technology change is rapid, and our fuel mix is primarily oil and gas. There's still a little coal in there, but it's mostly oil and gas. So those assumptions get us to what was referred to as A1FI, the fuel-intensive scenario. And the emissions, if you look at it and you chart the emissions from that, it's the worst case. It's the largest output of emissions that people thought would be possible. And this was only 6 years ago they were thinking. You know, they kind of laid this out and said, okay, we're not there, we're not going there, but that's the worst case. It's kind of over in the corner.
And so they were looking at what, 3-4 degrees maybe if we went that direction?